The bad guys were going to win. I spent the next 24 hours in a frantic funk, obsessively checking the scoreboard every 5 seconds, expecting the end to come at any moment. Sorrento, or one of his many Halliday experts, had obviously been able to decipher the riddle and locate the second gate. But even though the proof was right there on the scoreboard, I still had a hard time believing it. Up until now, the Sixers had only made progress by tracking Artemis, H, or me. How had those same clueless asshats found the second gate on their own? Maybe they'd just gotten lucky. Or perhaps they'd discovered some new and innovative way to cheat. How else could they have solved the riddle so quickly when Artemis hadn't been able to do it with several days' head start? My brain felt like hammered Play-Doh. I couldn't make any sense of the clue printed on the jade key. I was completely out of ideas, even lame ones. I didn't know what to do or where to look next. As the night went on, the Sixers continued to acquire copies of the crystal key. Each time one of their scores increased, it was like a knife in my heart. But I couldn't make myself stop checking the scoreboard. I was utterly transfixed. I felt myself inching toward complete hopelessness. My efforts over the past 5 years had been for nothing. I'd foolishly underestimated Sorrento and the Sixers, and I was about to pay the ultimate price for my hubris. Those soulless corporate lackeys were closing in on the egg at this very moment. I could sense it with every fiber of my being. I'd already lost Artemis, and now I was going to lose the contest too. I'd already decided what I was going to do when it happened. First, I would choose one of the kids in my official fan club, someone with no money and a first-level newbie avatar, and I would give her every item I owned. Then, I would activate the self-destruct sequence on my stronghold and sit in my command center while the whole place went up in a massive thermonuclear explosion. My avatar would die, and Game Over would appear in the center of my display. Then, I would rip off my visor and leave my apartment for the first time in 6 months. I would ride the elevator up to the roof. Or maybe I would even take the stairs, get a little exercise. There was an arboretum on the roof of my apartment building. I had never visited it, but I'd seen photos and admired the view via webcam. A transparent plexiglass barrier had been installed around the ledge to keep people from jumping, but it was a joke. At least 3 determined individuals had managed to climb over it since I'd moved in. I would sit up there and breathe the unfiltered city air for a while, feeling the wind on my skin. Then I would scale the barrier and hurl myself over the side. This was my current plan. I was trying to decide what tune I should whistle as I plummeted to my death when my phone rang. It was Shoto. I wasn't in the mood to talk, so I let his call roll to vidmail, then watched as Shoto recorded his message. It was brief. He said he needed to come to my stronghold to give me something, something Daito had left to me in his will. When I returned his call to arrange a meeting, I could tell Shoto was an emotional wreck. His quiet voice was filled with pain, and the depth of his despair was apparent on the features of his avatar's face. He seemed utterly despondent, in even worse shape than I was. I asked Shoto why his brother had bothered to make out a will for his avatar instead of just leaving his possessions in Shoto's care. Then Daito could simply create a new avatar and reclaim the items his brother was holding for him. But Shoto told me that his brother would not be creating a new avatar, not now or ever. When I asked why, he promised to explain when he saw me in person. Chapter 25. Max alerted me when Shoto arrived an hour or so later. I granted his ship clearance to enter Falco's airspace and told him to park in my hangar. Shoto's vessel was a large interplanetary trawler named the Kurosawa, modeled after a ship called the Bebop in the classic anime series Cowboy Bebop. Daito and Shoto had used it as their mobile base of operations for as long as I'd known them. The ship was so big that it barely fit through my hangar doors. I was standing on the runway to greet Shoto as he emerged from the Kurosawa. He was dressed in black mourning robes, and his face bore the same inconsolable expression I'd seen when we spoke on the phone. "Parzival-san," he said, bowing low. "Shoto-san." I returned the bow respectfully, then stretched out my palm, a gesture he recognized from the time we'd spent questing together. Grinning, he reached out and slipped me some skin. But then, his dark expression immediately resurfaced. This was the first time I'd seen Shoto since the quest we'd shared on Takosatsu, not counting those Daisho energy drink commercials he and his brother appeared in, and his avatar seemed to be a few inches taller than I remembered. I led him up to one of my stronghold's rarely used sitting rooms, a recreation of the living room set from Family Ties. Shoto recognized the decor and nodded his silent approval. Then, ignoring the furniture, he seated himself in the center of the floor. He sat Saiza style, folding his legs under his thighs. I did the same, positioning myself so that our avatars faced each other. We sat in silence for a while. When Shoto was finally ready to speak, he kept his eyes on the floor. "The Sixers killed my brother last night," he said, almost whispering. At first, I was too stunned to reply. "You mean they killed his avatar?" I asked, even though I could already tell that wasn't what he meant. Shoto shook his head. "No. They broke into his apartment, pulled him out of his haptic chair, and threw him off his balcony. He lived on the 43rd floor." Shoto opened a browser window in the air beside us. It displayed a Japanese newsfeed article. I tapped it with my index finger, and the Mandarax software translated the text to English. The headline was, "Another Otaku Suicide." The brief article below said that a young man, Toshiro Yoshiaki, age 22, had jumped to his death from his apartment located on the 43rd floor of a converted hotel in Shinjuku, Tokyo, where he lived alone. I saw a school photo of Toshiro beside the article. He was a young Japanese man with long, unkempt hair and bad skin. He didn't look anything like his Oasis avatar. When Shoto saw that I'd finished reading, he closed the window. I hesitated for a moment before asking, "Are you sure he didn't really commit suicide? Because his avatar had been killed?" "No," Shoto said. "Daito did not commit seppuku. I'm sure of it. The Sixers broke into his apartment while we were engaged in combat with them on Froboz. That's how they were able to defeat his avatar, by killing him in the real world." "I'm sorry, Shoto." I didn't know what else to say. I knew he was telling the truth. "My real name is Akihide," he said. "I want you to know my true name." I smiled, then bowed, briefly pressing my forehead to the floor. "I appreciate your trusting me with your true name," I said. "My true name is Wade." I could no longer see the point in keeping secrets. "Thank you, Wade," Shoto said, returning the bow. "You're welcome, Akihide." He was silent for a moment. Then he cleared his throat and began to talk about Daito. The words poured out of him. It was obvious he needed to talk to someone about what had happened, about what he'd lost. "Daito's real name was Toshiro Yoshiaki. I didn't even know that until last night, until I saw the news article." "But I thought you were his brother." I'd always assumed that Daito and Shoto lived together, that they shared an apartment or something. "My relationship with Daito is difficult to explain." He stopped to clear his throat. "We were not brothers. not in real life, just in the oasis. Do you understand? We only knew each other online. I never actually met him. He slowly raised his eyes to meet my gaze, to see if I was judging him. I reached out and rested a hand on his shoulder. Believe me, Shoto, I understand. H and Artemis are my two best friends, and I've never met either of them in real life either. In fact, you are one of my closest friends too. He bowed his head. Thank you. I could tell by his voice that he was crying now. We're Gunters, I said, trying to fill the awkward silence. We live here, in the oasis. For us, this is the only reality that has any meaning. Akihide nodded. A few moments later, he continued to talk. He told me how he and Toshiro had met 6 years ago, when they were both enrolled in an oasis support group for hikikomori, young people who had withdrawn from society and chosen to live in total isolation. Hikikomori locked themselves in a room, read manga, and cruised the oasis all day, relying on their families to bring them food. There had been hikikomori in Japan since back before the turn of the century, but their number had skyrocketed after the hunt for Halliday's Easter egg began. Millions of young men and women all over the country had locked themselves away from the world. They sometimes called these children the missing millions. Akihide and Toshiro became best friends and spent almost every day hanging out together in the oasis. When the hunt for Halliday's Easter egg began, they'd immediately decided to join forces and search for it together. They made a perfect team because Toshiro was a prodigy at video games, while the much younger Akihide was well-versed in American pop culture. Akihide's grandmother had attended school in the United States, and both of his parents had been born there, so Akihide had been raised on American movies and television, and he'd grown up learning to speak English and Japanese equally well. Akihide and Toshiro's mutual love of samurai movies served as the inspiration for their avatars' names and appearances. Shoto and Daito had grown so close that they were now like brothers. So when they created their new Gunter identities, they decided that, in the oasis, they were brothers from that moment on. After Shoto and Daito cleared the first gate and became famous, they gave several interviews with the media. They kept their identities a secret, but they did reveal that they were both Japanese, which made them instant celebrities in Japan. They began to endorse Japanese products and had a cartoon and a live-action TV series based on their exploits. At the height of their fame, Shoto had suggested to Daito that perhaps it was time for them to meet in person. Daito had flown into a rage and stopped speaking to Shoto for several days. After that, Shoto had never suggested it again. Eventually, Shoto worked his way up to telling me how Daito's avatar had died. The two of them had been aboard the Kurosawa, cruising between planets in Sector 7 when the scoreboard informed them that H had obtained the Jade Key. When that happened, they knew the Sixers would use Findoro's Tablet of Finding to pinpoint H's exact location and that their ships would soon be converging on it. In preparation for this, Daito and Shoto had spent the past few weeks planting microscopic tracking devices on the hulls of every Sixer gunship they could find. Using these devices, they were able to follow the gunships when they all abruptly changed course and headed for Froboz. As soon as Shoto and Daito learned that Froboz was the Sixers' destination, they'd easily deciphered the meaning of the quatrain. And by the time they reached Froboz, just a few minutes later, they'd already figured out what they needed to do to obtain the Jade Key. They landed the Kurosawa next to an instance of the White House that was still deserted. Shoto ran inside to collect the 19 treasures and get the key, while Daito remained outside to stand guard. Shoto worked quickly, and he only had 2 treasures left to collect when Daito informed him by comlink that 10 Sixer gunships were closing in on their location. He told his brother to hurry and promised to hold off the enemy until Shoto had the Jade Key. Neither of them knew if they'd have another chance to reach it. As Shoto scrambled to get the last two treasures and place them in the trophy case, he remotely activated one of the Kurosawa's external cameras and used it to record a short video of Daito's confrontation with the approaching Sixers. Shoto opened a window and played this video clip for me, but he averted his eyes until it was over. He obviously had no desire to watch it again. On the vid feed, I saw Daito standing alone in the field beside the White House. A small fleet of Sixer gunships was descending out of the sky, and they began to fire their laser cannons as soon as they were within range. A hailstorm of fiery red bolts began to rain down all around Daito. Behind him, in the distance, I could see more Sixer gunships setting down, and each one was offloading squadrons of power-armored ground troops. Daito was surrounded. The Sixers had obviously spotted the Kurosawa during its descent to the planet's surface, and they'd made killing the two samurai a priority. Daito didn't hesitate to use the ace up his sleeve. He pulled out the beta capsule, held it aloft in his right hand, and activated it. His avatar instantly changed into Ultraman, a glowing-eyed, red and silver alien superhero. As his avatar transformed, he also grew to a height of 156 feet. The Sixer ground forces closing in on him froze in their tracks, staring up in frightened awe as Ultraman Daito snatched two gunships out of the sky and smashed them together, like a giant child playing with two tiny metal toys. He dropped the flaming wreckage to the ground and began to swat other Sixer gunships out of the sky like bothersome flies. The ships that escaped his deadly grasp banked around and sprayed him with laser bolts and machine gun fire, but both deflected harmlessly off his armored alien skin. Daito let out a booming laugh that echoed across the landscape. Then he made a cross with his arms, intersecting at the wrists. A glowing energy beam blasted forth from his hands, vaporizing half a dozen gunships unlucky enough to fly through its path. Daito turned and swept the beam over the Sixer ground forces around him, frying them like terrified ants under a magnifying glass. Daito appeared to be enjoying himself immensely, so much so that he paid little attention to the warning light embedded in the center of his chest, which had now begun to flash bright red. This was a signal that his 3 minutes as Ultraman had nearly elapsed and that his power was almost depleted. This time limit was Ultraman's primary weakness. If Daito failed to deactivate the beta capsule and return to human form before his 3 minutes were up, his avatar would die. But it was obvious that if he changed back into his human form right now, in the middle of the massive Sixer onslaught, he'd be killed instantly too. And Shoto would never be able to reach the ship. I could see the Sixer troops around Daito screaming into their comlinks for backup, and additional Sixer gunships were still arriving in droves. Daito was blasting them out of the sky one at a time with perfectly aimed bursts of his specium ray. And, with each blast he fired, the warning light on his chest pulsed faster. Then, Shoto emerged from the White House and told his brother via comlink that he'd acquired the Jade Key. In that same instant, the Sixer ground forces spotted Shoto, and sensing a much easier target, they began to redirect their fire at his avatar. Shoto made a mad dash for the Kurosawa. When he activated the boots of speed he was wearing, his avatar became a barely visible blur racing across the open field. As Shoto ran, Daito repositioned his giant form to provide him with as much cover as possible. Still firing energy blasts, he was able to keep the Sixers at bay. Then, Daito's voice broke in on the comlink. "Shoto!" he shouted. "I think someone is here! Someone is inside!" His voice cut off. At the same moment, his avatar froze as if he'd been turned to stone, and a logout icon appeared directly over his head. Logging out of your Oasis account while you were engaged in combat was the same thing as committing suicide. During the logout sequence, your avatar froze in place for 60 seconds, during which time you were totally defenseless and susceptible to attack. The logout sequence was designed this way to prevent avatars from using it as an easy way to escape a fight. You had to stand your ground or retreat to a safe location before you could log out. Daito's logout sequence had been engaged at the worst possible moment. As soon as his avatar froze, he began to take heavy laser and gunfire from all directions. The red warning light on his chest began to flash faster and faster until it finally went solid red. When that happened, Daito's giant form fell over and collapsed. As he fell, he barely missed crushing Shoto and the Kurosawa. As he hit the ground, his avatar's body transformed and shrank back to its normal size and appearance. Then it began to disappear altogether, slowly fading out of existence. When Daito's avatar vanished completely, it left behind a small pile of spinning items on the ground, everything he'd been carrying in his inventory, including the beta capsule. He was dead. I saw another blur of motion on the vid feed as Shoto ran back to collect Daito's items. Then he looped around and ran back aboard the Kurosawa. The ship lifted off and blasted into orbit, taking heavy fire the entire way. I was reminded of my own desperate escape from Froboz. Luckily for Shoto, his brother had wiped out most of the Sixer gunships in the vicinity and reinforcements had yet to arrive. Shoto was able to reach orbit and escape by making the jump to light speed, but just barely. The video ended, and Shoto closed the window. "How do you think the Sixers found out where he lived?" I asked. "I don't know," Shoto said. "Daito was careful. He covered his tracks." "If they found him, they might be able to find you, too," I said. "I know. I've taken precautions." "Good." Shoto removed the beta capsule from his inventory and held it out to me. "Daito would have wanted you to have this." I held up a hand. "No, I think you should keep it. You might need it." Shoto shook his head. "I have all of his other items," he said. "I don't need this, and I don't want it." He held the capsule out to me, insistent. I took the artifact and examined it. It was a small metal cylinder, silver and black in color, with a red activation button on its side. Its size and shape reminded me of the lightsabers I owned, but lightsabers were a dime a dozen. I had over 50 in my collection. There was only one beta capsule, and it was a far more powerful weapon. I raised the capsule with both hands and bowed. "Thank you, Shoto-san." "Thank you, Parzival," he said, returning the bow. "Thank you for listening." He stood up slowly. Everything about his body language seemed to signal defeat. "You haven't given up yet, have you?" I asked. "Of course not." He straightened his body and gave me a dark smile. "But finding the egg is no longer my goal. Now I have a new quest, a far more important one. And that is revenge." I nodded. Then I walked over and took down one of the samurai swords mounted on the wall and presented it to Shoto. "Please," I said, "accept this gift to aid you in your new quest." Shoto took the sword and drew its ornate blade a few inches from the scabbard. "A Masamune?" he asked, staring at the blade in wonder. I nodded. "Yes. And it's a +5 Vorpal blade, too." Shoto bowed again to show his gratitude. "Arigato." We rode the elevator back down to my hangar in silence. Just before he boarded his ship, Shoto turned to me. "How long do you think it will take the Sixers to clear the third gate?" he asked. "I don't know," I said. "Hopefully long enough for us to catch up with them." "It's not over until the fat lady is singing, right?" I nodded. "It's not over until it's over. And it's not over yet." Chapter 26. I figured it out later that night, a few hours after Shoto left my stronghold. I was sitting in my command center, holding the jade key and endlessly reciting the clue printed on its surface. "Continue your quest by taking the test." In my other hand, I held the silver foil wrapper. My eyes darted from the key to the wrapper and back to the key again as I tried desperately to make the connection between them. I'd been doing this for hours, and it wasn't getting me anywhere. I sighed and put the key away, then laid the wrapper flat on the control panel in front of me. I carefully smoothed out all of its folds and wrinkles. The wrapper was square in shape, 6 inches long on each edge, silver foil on one side, dull white paper on the other. I pulled up some image analysis software and made a high-resolution scan of both sides of the wrapper. Then I magnified both images on my display and studied every micrometer. I couldn't find any markings or writing anywhere on either side of the wrapper's surface. I was eating some corn chips at the time, so I was using voice commands to operate the image analysis software. I instructed it to demagnify the scan of the wrapper and center the image on my display. As I did this, it reminded me of a scene in Blade Runner, where Harrison Ford's character Deckard uses a similar voice-controlled scanner to analyze a photograph. I held up the wrapper and took another look at it. As the virtual light reflected off its foil surface, I thought about folding the wrapper into a paper airplane and sailing it across the room. That made me think of origami, which reminded me of another moment from Blade Runner, one of the final scenes in the film. And that was when it hit me. "The unicorn," I whispered. The moment I said the word unicorn aloud, the wrapper began to fold on its own, there in the palm of my hand. The square piece of foil bent itself in half diagonally, creating a silver triangle. It continued to bend and fold itself into smaller triangles and even smaller diamond shapes, until at last it formed a four-legged figure that then sprouted a tail, a head, and finally, a horn. The wrapper had folded itself into a silver origami unicorn, one of the most iconic images from Blade Runner. I was already riding the elevator down to my hangar and shouting at Max to prep the Vonnegut for takeoff. "Continue your quest by taking the test." Now I knew exactly what test that line referred to and where I needed to go to take it. The origami unicorn had revealed everything to me. Blade Runner was referenced in the text of Anorak's Almanac no less than 14 times. It had been one of Halliday's top 10 all-time favorite films, and the film was based on a novel by Philip K. Dick, one of Halliday's favorite authors. For these reasons, I'd seen Blade Runner over 4 dozen times and had memorized every frame of the film and every line of dialogue. As the Vonnegut streaked through hyperspace, I pulled the director's cut of Blade Runner up in a window on my display, then jumped ahead to review 2 scenes in particular. The movie, released in 1982, is set in Los Angeles in the year 2019, in a sprawling, hyper-technological future that had never come to pass. The story follows a guy named Rick Deckard, played by Harrison Ford. Deckard works as a Blade Runner, a special type of cop who hunts down and kills replicants, genetically engineered beings that are almost indistinguishable from real humans. In fact, replicants look and act so much like real humans that the only way a Blade Runner can spot one is by using a polygraph-like device called a Voight-Kampff machine to test them. "Continue your quest by taking the test." Voight-Kampff machines appear in only 2 scenes in the movie. Both of those take place inside the Terrell Building, an enormous double pyramid structure that houses the Terrell Corporation, the company that manufactures the replicants. Recreations of the Terrell Building were among the most common structures in the Oasis. Copies of it existed on hundreds of different planets, spread throughout all 27 sectors. This was because the code for the building was included as a free built-in template in the Oasis World Builder construction software, along with hundreds of other structures borrowed from various science fiction films and television series. So, for the past 25 years, whenever someone used the World Builder software to create a new planet inside the Oasis, they could just select the Terrell building from a drop-down menu and insert a copy of it into their simulation to help fill out the skyline of whatever futuristic city or landscape they were coding. As a result, some worlds had over a dozen copies of the Terrell building scattered across their surfaces. I was currently hauling ass at light speed to the closest such world, a cyberpunk-themed planet in Sector 22 called Axrenox. If my suspicion was correct, every copy of the Terrell building on Axrenox contained a hidden entrance into the second gate through the Voight-Kampff machines located inside. I wasn't worried about running into the Sixers because there was no way they could have barricaded the second gate, not with thousands of copies of the Terrell building on hundreds of different worlds. Once I reached Axrenox, finding a copy of the Terrell building took only a few minutes. It was pretty hard to miss. A massive pyramid-shaped structure covering several square kilometers at its base, it towered above most of the structures adjacent to it. I zeroed in on the first instance of the building I saw and headed straight for it. My ship's cloaking device was already engaged, and I left it activated when I set the Vonnegut down on one of the Terrell building's landing pads. Then, I locked the ship and activated all of its security systems, hoping they'd be enough to keep it from getting stolen until I returned. Magic didn't function here, so I couldn't just shrink the ship and put it in my pocket. And leaving your vessel parked out in the open on a cyberpunk-themed world like Axrenox was like asking for it to get ripped off. The Vonnegut would be a target for the first leather-clad booster gang that spotted it. I pulled up a map of the Terrell building template's layout and used it to locate a roof access elevator a short distance from the platform where I'd landed. When I reached the elevator, I punched in the default security code on the code pad and crossed my fingers. I got lucky. The elevator doors hissed open. Whoever had created this section of the Axrenox cityscape hadn't bothered to reset the security codes in the template. I took this as a good sign. It meant they'd probably left everything else in the template at the default setting, too. As I rode the elevator down to the 440th floor, I powered on my armor and drew my guns. Five security checkpoints stood between the elevator and the room I needed to reach. Unless the template had been altered, 50 NPC Terrell security guard replicants would be standing between me and my destination. The shooting started as soon as the elevator doors slid open. I had to kill 7 skin jobs before I could even make it out of the elevator car and into the hallway. The next 10 minutes played out like the climax of a John Woo movie, one of the ones starring Chow Yun-fat, like Hard Boiled or The Killer. I switched both of my guns to auto-fire and held down the triggers as I moved from one room to the next, mowing down every NPC in my path. The guards returned fire, but their bullets pinged harmlessly off my armor. I never ran out of ammo, because each time I fired a round, a new round was teleported into the bottom of the clip. My bullet bill this month was going to be huge. When I finally reached my destination, I punched in another code and locked the door behind me. I knew I didn't have much time. Klaxons were blaring throughout the building, and the thousands of NPC guards stationed on the floors below were probably already on their way up here to find me. My footsteps echoed as I entered the room. It was deserted, except for a large owl sitting on a golden perch. It blinked at me silently as I crossed the enormous cathedral-like room, which was a perfect recreation of the office of the Terrell Corporation's founder, Eldon Terrell. Every detail from the film had been duplicated exactly. Polished stone floors. Giant marble pillars. The entire west wall was a massive floor-to-ceiling window offering a breathtaking view of the vast cityscape outside. A long conference table stood beside the window. Sitting on top of it was a Voight-Kampff machine. It was about the size of a briefcase, with a row of unlabeled buttons on the front, next to three small data monitors. When I walked up and sat down in front of the machine, it turned itself on. A thin robotic arm extended a circular device that looked like a retinal scanner, which locked into place directly level with the pupil of my right eye. A small bellows was built into the side of the machine, and it began to rise and fall, giving the impression that the device was breathing. I glanced around, wondering if an NPC of Harrison Ford would appear to ask me the same questions he asked Sean Young in the movie. I'd memorized all of her answers, just in case. But I waited a few seconds, and nothing happened. The machine's bellows continued to rise and fall. In the distance, the security klaxons continued to wail. I took out the jade key. The instant I did, a panel slid open in the surface of the Voight-Kampff machine, revealing a keyhole. I quickly inserted the jade key and turned it. The machine and the key both vanished, and in their place, the second gate appeared. It was a door-like portal resting on top of the polished conference table. Its edges glowed with the same milky jade color as the key, and just like the first gate, it appeared to lead into a vast field of stars. I leapt up on the table and jumped inside. I found myself standing just inside the entrance of a seedy-looking bowling alley with disco-era decor. The carpet was a garish pattern of green and brown swirls, and the molded plastic chairs were a faded orange color. The bowling lanes were all empty and unlit. The place was deserted. There weren't even any NPCs behind the front counter or the snack bar. I wasn't sure where I was supposed to be until I saw Middletown Lanes printed in huge letters on the wall above the bowling lanes. At first, the only sound I heard was the low hum of the fluorescent lights overhead. But then I noticed a series of faint electronic chirps emanating from off to my left. I glanced in that direction and saw a darkened alcove just beyond the snack bar. Over this cave-like entrance was a sign. Eight bright red neon letters spelled out the words, Game Room. There was a violent rush of wind and the roar of what sounded like a hurricane tearing through the bowling alley. My feet began to slide across the carpet, and I realized that my avatar was being pulled toward the game room, as if a black hole had opened up somewhere in there. As the vacuum yanked me through the game room entrance, I spotted a dozen video games inside, all from the mid to late 80s. Crime Fighters, Heavy Barrel, Vigilante, Smash TV. But I could now see that my avatar was being drawn toward one game in particular, a game that stood alone at the very back of the game room. Black Tiger, Capcom, 1987. A swirling vortex had opened in the center of the game's monitor, and it was sucking in bits of trash, paper cups, bowling shoes, everything that wasn't nailed down, including me. As my avatar neared it, I reflexively reached out and grabbed the joystick of a time pilot machine. My feet were instantly lifted off the floor as the vortex continued to pull my avatar inexorably toward it. At this point, I was actually grinning in anticipation. I was all prepared to pat myself on the back because I'd mastered Black Tiger long ago during the first year of the hunt. In the years prior to his death, when Halliday had been living in seclusion, the only thing he'd posted on his website was a brief looping animation. It showed his avatar, Anorak, sitting in his castle's library, mixing potions and poring over dusty spellbooks. This animation had run on a continuous loop for over a decade until it was finally replaced by the scoreboard on the morning Halliday died. In that animation, Hanging on the wall behind Anorak, you could see a large painting of a black dragon. Gunters had filled countless message board threads arguing about the meaning of the painting, about what the black dragon signified or whether it signified anything at all. But I'd been sure of its meaning from the start. In one of the earliest journal entries in Anorak's almanac, Halliday wrote that whenever his parents would start screaming at each other, he would sneak out of the house and ride his bike to the local bowling alley to play Black Tiger, because it was a game he could beat on just one quarter. AA23-234. For one quarter, Black Tiger lets me escape from my rotten existence for three glorious hours. Pretty good deal. Black Tiger had first been released in Japan under its original title, Buraku Doragon, Black Dragon. The game had been renamed for its American release. I'd deduced that the black dragon painting on the wall of Anorak's study had been a subtle hint that Buraku Doragon would play a key role in the hunt. So I'd studied the game until, like Halliday, I could reach the end on just one credit. After that, I continued to play it every few months just to keep from getting rusty. Now, it looked as if my foresight and diligence were about to pay off. I was only able to hold on to the Time Pilot joystick for a few seconds. Then, I lost my grip, and my avatar was sucked directly into the Black Tiger game's monitor. Everything went black for a moment. Then I found myself in surreal surroundings. I was now standing inside a narrow dungeon corridor. On my left was a high gray cobblestone wall with a mammoth dragon skull mounted on it. The wall stretched up and up, vanishing into the shadows above. I couldn't make out any ceiling. The dungeon floor was composed of floating, circular platforms arranged end to end in a long line that stretched out into the darkness ahead. To my right, beyond the platform's edge, there was nothing, just an endless, empty black void. I turned around, but there was no exit behind me, just another high cobblestone wall stretching up into the infinite blackness overhead. I looked down at my avatar's body. I now looked exactly like the hero of Black Tiger, a muscular, half-naked barbarian warrior dressed in an armored thong and a horned helmet. My right arm disappeared in a strange metal gauntlet from which hung a long retractable chain with a spiked metal ball on the end. My right hand deftly held three throwing daggers. When I hurled them off in the black void at my right, three more identical daggers instantly appeared in my hand. When I tried jumping, I discovered that I could leap 30 feet straight up and land back on my feet with cat-like grace. Now I understood. I was about to play Black Tiger all right, but not the 50-year-old 2D side-scrolling platform game that I had mastered. I was now standing inside a new, immersive, three-dimensional version of the game that Halliday had created. My knowledge of the original game's mechanics, levels, and enemies would definitely come in handy, but the gameplay was going to be completely different, and it would require an entirely different set of skills. The first gate had placed me inside one of Halliday's favorite movies. And now the second gate had put me inside one of his favorite video games. While I was pondering the implication of this pattern, a message began to flash on my display. Go! I looked around. An arrow etched into the stone wall on my left pointed the way forward. I stretched my arms and legs, cracked my knuckles, and took a deep breath. Then, readying my weapons, I ran forward, leaping from platform to platform to confront the first of my adversaries. Halliday had faithfully recreated every detail of Black Tiger's 8-level dungeon. I got off to a rough start and lost a life before I even cleared the first boss. But then I began to acclimate to playing the game in three dimensions and from a first-person perspective. Eventually, I found my groove. I pressed onward, leaping from platform to platform, attacking in midair, dodging the relentless onslaught of blobs, skeletons, snakes, mummies, minotaurs, and, yes, ninjas. Each enemy I vanquished dropped a pile of Zenny coins that I could later use to purchase armor, weapons, and potions from one of the bearded wise men scattered throughout each level. These wise men apparently thought setting up a small shop in the middle of a monster-infested dungeon was a fine idea. There were no timeouts and no way for me to pause the game. Once you entered a gate, you couldn't just stop and log out. The system wouldn't allow it. Even if you removed your visor, you would remain logged in. The only way out of a gate was to go through it or die. I managed to clear all 8 levels of the game in just under 3 hours. The closest I came to death was during my battle with the final boss, the Black Dragon, who, of course, looked exactly like the beast depicted in the painting in Anorak's study. I'd used up all of my extra lives, and my vitality bar was almost at zero, but I managed to keep moving and stay clear of the dragon's fiery breath while I slowly knocked down his life meter with a steady barrage of throwing daggers. When I struck the final killing blow, the dragon crumbled into digital dust in front of me. I let out a long, exhausted sigh of relief. Then, with no transition whatsoever, I found myself back in the bowling alley game room, standing in front of the Black Tiger game. In front of me, on the game's monitor, my armored barbarian was striking a heroic pose. The following text appeared below him. "You have returned peace and prosperity to our nation. Thank you, Black Tiger. Congratulations on your strength and wisdom." Then something strange happened. Something that had never happened when I'd beaten the original game. One of the wise men from the dungeon appeared on the screen with a speech balloon that said, "Thank you. I am indebted to you. Please accept a giant robot as your reward." A long row of robot icons appeared below the wise man, stretching across the screen horizontally. By moving the joystick left or right, I found that I was able to scroll through a selection of over 100 different giant robots. When one of these robots was highlighted, a detailed list of its stats and weaponry appeared on the screen beside it. There were several robots I didn't recognize, but most were familiar. I spotted Gigantor, Transor Z, the Iron Giant, Jet Jaguar, the Sphinx-headed Giant Robo from Johnny Sacco and his flying robot, the entire Shogun Warriors toy line, and many of the mechs featured in both the Macross and Gundam anime series. 11 of these icons were grayed out and had a red X over them, and these robots could not be identified or selected. I knew they must be the ones taken by Sorrento and the other Sixers who had cleared this gate before me. It seemed possible that I was about to be awarded a real, working recreation of whichever robot I selected, so I studied my options carefully, searching for the one I thought would be the most powerful and well-armed. But I stopped cold when I saw Leopardon, the giant transforming robot used by Supaidaman, the incarnation of Spider-Man, who appeared on Japanese TV in the late 1970s. I discovered Supaidaman during the course of my research and had become somewhat obsessed with the show, so I didn't care if Leopardon was the most powerful robot available. I had to have him regardless. I highlighted that icon and tapped the fire button. A 12-inch tall replica of Leopardon appeared on top of the Black Tiger cabinet. I grabbed it and placed it in my inventory. There were no instructions, and the item description field was blank. I made a mental note to examine it later when I got back to my stronghold. Meanwhile, on the Black Tiger monitor, the end credits had begun to scroll over an image of the game's barbarian hero sitting on a throne with a slender princess at his side. I respectfully read each of the programmers' names. These were all Japanese, except for the very last credit, which read, Oasis Port by J.D. Halliday. When the credits ended, the monitor went dark for a moment. Then, a symbol slowly appeared in the center of the screen, a glowing red circle with a five-pointed star inside it. The points of the star extended just beyond the outer edge of the circle. A second later, an image of the crystal key appeared, spinning slowly in the center of the glowing red star. I felt a rush of adrenaline because I recognized the red star symbol and I knew where it was meant to lead me. I snapped several screenshots just to be safe. A moment later, the monitor went dark and the Black Tiger game cabinet melted and morphed into a door-shaped portal with glowing jade edges. The exit. I let out a triumphant cheer and jumped through it. Chapter 27. When I emerged from the gate, my avatar reappeared back inside Terrell's office. The Voight-Kampff machine had reappeared in its original location, resting on the table beside me. I checked the time. Over 3 hours had passed since I'd first entered the gate. The room was deserted, save for the owl, and the security klaxons were no longer wailing. The NPC guards must have busted in and searched this area while I was still inside the gate, because they no longer appeared to be looking for me. The coast was clear. I made my way back to the elevator and up to the landing platform without incident. And thanks be to Crom, the Vonnegut was still parked right where I'd left it, its cloaking device still engaged. I ran on board and left Axrenox, jumping to light speed as soon as I reached orbit. As the Vonnegut streaked through hyperspace, headed for the nearest stargate, I pulled up one of the screenshots I'd taken of the red star symbol. Then, I opened my Grail diary and accessed the subfolder devoted to the legendary Canadian rock band, Rush. Rush had been Halliday's favorite band from his teens onward. He'd once revealed in an interview that he'd coded every single one of his video games, including the Oasis, while listening exclusively to Rush albums. He often referred to Rush's three members, Neil Peart, Alex Lifeson, and Geddy Lee, as the Holy Trinity, or the Gods of the North. In my Grail diary, I had every single Rush song, album, bootleg, and music video ever made. I had high-res scans of all their liner notes and album artwork. Every frame of Rush concert footage in existence. Every radio and television interview the band had ever done. Unabridged biographies on each band member, along with copies of their side projects and solo work. I pulled up the band's discography and selected the album I was looking for. 2112, Rush's classic sci-fi themed concept album. A high-resolution scan of the album's cover appeared on my display. The band's name and the album's title were printed over a field of stars, and below that, appearing as if reflected in the surface of a rippling lake, was the symbol I'd seen on the Black Tiger Games monitor, a red, five-pointed star enclosed in a circle. When I placed the album cover side by side with the screenshot of the game screen, the two symbols matched exactly. 2112's title track is an epic seven-part song, over 20 minutes in length. The song tells the story of an anonymous rebel living in the year 2112, a time when creativity and self-expression have been outlawed. The red star on the album's cover was the symbol of the Solar Federation, the oppressive interstellar society in the story. The Solar Federation was controlled by a group of priests who are described in part 2 of the song titled The Temples of Syrinx. Its lyrics told me exactly where the crystal key was hidden. We are the priests of the temples of Syrinx. Our great computers fill the hallowed halls. We are the priests of the temples of Syrinx. All the gifts of life are held within our walls. There was a planet in Sector 21 named Syrinx. That was where I was headed now. The Oasis Atlas described Syrinx as a desolate world with rocky terrain and no NPC inhabitants. When I accessed the planet's colophon, I saw that Syrinx's author was listed as anonymous. But I knew the planet must have been coded by Halliday because its design matched the world described in 2112's liner notes. 2112 was originally released in 1976, back when most music was sold on 12-inch vinyl records. The records came in cardboard sleeves with artwork and a track listing printed on them. Some album sleeves opened up like a book and included more artwork and liner notes inside, along with lyrics and information about the band. As I pulled up a scan of 2112's original fold-out album sleeve, I saw that there was a second image of the red star symbol on the inside. This one depicted a naked man cowering in front of the star, both his hands raised in fear. On the opposite side of the record sleeve were the printed lyrics to all 7 parts of the 2112 suite. The lyrics for each section were preceded by a paragraph of prose that augmented the narrative laid out in the lyrics. These brief vignettes were told from the point of view of 2112's anonymous protagonist. The following text preceded the lyrics to part 1. I lie awake, staring out at the bleakness of Megadon. City and sky become one, merging into a single plane, a vast sea of unbroken gray. The twin moons, just 2 pale orbs as they trace their way across the steely sky. When my ship reached Syrinx, I saw the twin moons, Bytor and Snowdog, that orbited the planet. Their names were taken from another classic Rush song. And down below, on the planet's bleak, gray surface, there were exactly 1,024 copies of Megadon, the domed city described in the liner notes. That was twice the number of Zork instances there'd been on Froboz, so I knew the Sixers couldn't barricade them all. With my cloaking device engaged, I selected the nearest instance of the city and landed the Vonnegut just outside the wall of its dome, watching my scopes for other ships. Megadon was anchored atop a rocky plateau on the edge of an immense cliff. The city appeared to be in ruins. Its massive transparent dome was riddled with cracks and looked as though it might collapse at any moment. I was able to enter the city by squeezing through one of the largest of these cracks at the base of the dome. The city of Megadon reminded me of an old 1950s sci-fi paperback cover painting depicting the crumbling ruins of a once great technologically advanced civilization. In the absolute center of the city, I found a towering obelisk-shaped temple with wind-blasted gray walls. A giant red star of the Solar Federation was emblazoned above the entrance. I was standing before the Temple of Syrinx. It wasn't covered by a force field or surrounded by a detachment of Sixers. There wasn't a soul in sight. I drew my guns and walked through the entrance of the temple. Inside, mammoth obelisk-shaped supercomputers stood in long rows, filling the giant cathedral-like temple. I wandered along these rows, listening to the deep hum of the machines until I finally reached the center of the temple. There, I found a raised stone altar with the five-pointed red star etched into its surface. As I stepped up to the altar, the humming of the computers ceased, and the chamber grew silent. It appeared I was supposed to place something on the altar, an offering to the temple of Syrinx,